Thank you, Ken. Good to be with you this morning. Good to see all of you here bright and early. So Barry and I enjoyed our time last night, and we really enjoyed the interaction with all of you in the question-answer time, so we hope to encourage that in each of the subsequent sessions. Last night we gave an overview, what is the solution to poverty? Now, we said that the solution fell in three categories, the economic system, the government, and the cultural beliefs and values. And the three sessions that we propose or present today are going to cover those three areas. The first one this morning is going to say what economic system is most helpful for producing prosperity. And we're going to say it's the free market system. I'm going to define the free market system in a minute, and we'll talk about it. And the afternoon session that Barry and I do, the first afternoon session that we do will be on what governmental safeguards are necessary to be sure the government serves the people and not just the rulers. So economic system, government, and then the last one we do is how do you change the cultural values in a country? Large change, or what has to be done. So right now I'm going to talk about the moral advantages of the free market system. What we hear endlessly is a free market system is evil because it depends on greed. Barry and I disagree with that, and we think that not enough attention has been paid to the moral advantages that come when a country adopts a free market system. Well, you say, what is a free market system? It's an economic system in which people, not the government, decide what is bought and sold and what is produced. It's a simple answer. Free market system depends on, it's a system where people, not the government, decide what is bought and sold and what is produced. As opposed to a controlled economy where the government decides how many of each color of product and size of product are produced, decides where you can work and what jobs you have to work at and how much you get paid. The government controls everything. Now you say, isn't there a spectrum? Yes, there is. There's a spectrum of free market to total control. And for instance, just to show some extremes of that system, South Korea is close to a free market system. North Korea is totally communist, totalitarian system. And we're saying, and the evidence proves this, that a free market system has many advantages. There are material advantages, but there are many moral advantages as well. Well, I mentioned North Korea and South Korea. I don't know if you've seen this aerial satellite photo. North and South Korea were divided in 1948. This is the difference in the two countries in October of 2006 from the air. South Korea is lit up here. It's a bustling economy, 12th richest country in the world. At night, there are lights on because it's an indication of prosperity. North Korea is here. Same language, same ethnic and cultural background, same region of the world, different government system. It's totally dark. Why? Because they have no electricity. They're that poor. Millions, more than 1 million, maybe 2 million or more people starve to death for lack of food in North Korea. The only difference is whether it's a government-controlled economy, totalitarian, complete control, or a free economy. Now, I should say, I look at that and I also see an indication of a spiritual reality here. The lights are almost metaphorical because North Korea, Operation World by Patrick Johnstone said in an earlier edition, no known Christians in North Korea. Now, I know there are Christians in North Korea because I've spoken to more than one person who has been in North Korea and visited with Christians, but they meet secretly. They don't meet publicly for worship. They don't evangelize. They don't write literature. They don't pass out evangelistic tracts or have Billy Graham revival crusades. They're persecuted mercilessly. North Korea. What I do know is every year, thousands of people are born, Thousands more go on and live their lives, and thousands more die without ever hearing the gospel of Jesus Christ in North Korea. South Korea, one of the most significant evangelical church movements of any country of the world, perhaps 20% or so of the population born-again Christians, and very strong churches putting out evangelistic activity, Christian literature, sending missionaries throughout the world. What's the difference? A free society versus a totalitarian society. So, I mean, that's just kind of an introduction. I didn't mean to get into this, but I thought while we were talking about the difference between a controlled economy and a free market system, there's, anyway, a free market system is what? Where, what? People decide what is bought and sold and what is produced, not the government. And in fact, if you start talking about a free market system with an economist or somebody who's had economic training, you'll get this quick response. There isn't any such thing as a free market system. There's some government control in every society. And it's just a question of how much government control you have. Various societies have different degrees of government control. You don't know what you're talking about because every economy is mixed. So let's talk about mixed economies now. Let's not talk about free markets. And what do you say? That kind of muddles the conversation, doesn't it? I mean, we think we have a free market system in the United States, but first-class postal service is regulated by the government. They decide what you buy and sell and how much the price is. In a lot of places, utilities are regulated by the government. We must have a mixed system too, right? Well, there's an answer. The Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. every year puts out something called Index of Economic Freedom. Barry and I carry this next to our Bibles because we're talking about this topic. This is the 2014 Index of Economic Freedom, and it studies all the countries of the world, and it ranks 178 countries from most free to least free, and it ranks them on 10 categories. Property rights, which we talked about last night, freedom from corruption, that is, you have to have bribes to get things done, and do people lie when they buy and sell things? Property rights, freedom from corruption, fiscal freedom, government spending. If government spending is really high, then, of course, it takes away a lot of money from the people, takes away freedom. Business freedom, labor freedom, monetary freedom, trade freedom, investment freedom, financial freedom. 10 categories. They give numerical scores to these. Each one of them can score from 1 to 10, and you add it up 10 scores, total possible score of 100, just like a term paper. And so countries can, and if you, on freedom from corruption, if you're ranking up 93-94% out of 100, you get an A, right? And so countries rank high in those freedom areas. But if you're down, freedom from corruption is down at 20%, that's a failing grade for sure. So they compile these. Most free country in the world, still ranked as an independent country, Hong Kong, then Singapore, Australia, Switzerland, New Zealand, Canada, Chile, Mauritius, Ireland, Denmark, Estonia, United States, 12, sad. We keep dropping every year. Least free countries of the world, number 178 at the bottom, North Korea. 177, Cuba. 176, Zimbabwe, that's Robert Mugabe. 175, Venezuela, that's where the current pope came from. So what this index says is they take, say, the top 20, the scores from 80 to 100 are basically, are mostly free. Country. Oh, no, from the top 20 or so are the mostly free economies. But anyway, it can be defined, it can be measured. So it isn't like a mystery, what is a free market? Okay, with that background, I want to say one more thing. When Barry and I were talking about this book and making these presentations, for a few months we were going talking about the advantages, the moral advantages of capitalism, as opposed to communism, socialism, feudalism, mercantilism, etc. And we kept getting immense feedback from people who just had many negative connotations in their minds to the word capitalism. And especially we got that pushback in Europe, especially in Hungary. We made some presentations and we couldn't even get people to listen to what we were talking about because capitalism was a word that just raised too many issues with people. So we decided to abandon the word capitalism for the purpose of this book and we use the word or the term free market instead. And we think it has a great advantage because free market carries an instinctive sense in the terms, carries an instinctive sense to people of what's the essence of what you're talking about in an economic system. It's people are free to decide what to buy and sell and what to produce. The word capitalism, it has so many different senses and talks about capital. Capital is not the essence of a free market system. Freedom of choice is. And so why use a term capitalism that was invented first by Karl Marx, an enemy of the system, to talk about a system that he disagreed with, instead of a term that has positive connotations to people? So we're talking about a free market system. We agree with the many good defenses of capitalism in the sense of a free market system that have been written before, and some people will go on using the term capitalism, and we understand that, but for our purposes, we're not using it. Does that make sense? Okay. So now, moral advantages of the system. First of all, free markets do not make morally perfect people. Just a qualification. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans 3:23. So Romans 3:23 reminds us that every economic system has sinful people in it, people who do morally wrong things. Free markets are not the cure for every conceivable human defect. So the question we should ask is not, do free markets make perfect people, or can you point to some bad examples of misconduct by people in a free market? Of course you can, in any country of the world. The question is this: does a free market system tend to discourage and punish wrong behavior? And does it tend to encourage and reward virtuous behavior better than any other economic system? And to that, the answer is unequivocally yes. Just as a kind of a overview of this, our book has 16 moral advantages to a free market system. I'm going to talk about four or five of them, perhaps, and you can look at the book for the rest. Barry will talk about the mechanics and how. I think, Barry, aren't you talking about how a free market system works? Prices? Okay. Well, we don't know what Barry's going to talk about in the second half right now. So, okay. That's what he does. He listens to me, and what I don't talk about, then he talks about. It works. I can't do that. Okay, number one, moral advantage, promoting freedom of choice for moral actions. A free market gives more freedom and responsibility to individuals to make economic decisions, and that allows us to make morally significant decisions. Think of the different. What's your name? Okay, Matt. If Matt earns $100 and he decides to give it to the poor or give it to the work of his church, that's a morally significant choice because he made it freely. If Matt earns $100 and the government takes it away from Matt and then gives it to the poor, or even gives it to support a church, Matt has lost the moral value of his choice because it's compelled. It's no longer. Does that make sense? When government takes money from you and decides how to spend it, you lose moral significance for your economic actions, because you can't any longer act as a responsible steward for your possessions. Paul says, 1 Corinthians 4:2, it is required of stewards that they be found faithful. Margaret and I have been in Russia. Margaret and I and Barry and Mandy have been in China. People there are very poor. The Christians we met are wonderfully heroic in their faith, but they have so little disposable income, so little choice of what they do with stewardship of their time or stewardship of their money. An economic system should not control people's actions. It should. It should influence people's actions by persuasion and not force. So free markets thrive on the non-aggression principle. They protect human freedom. In buying and selling in a free market, force is impermissible. It depends in a free market on voluntary exchanges. And I just want to remind you how much value the Bible places on freedom of voluntary choice. Look, I'm on the Southern Seminary campus. I am a five-point Calvinist. I believe in God's sovereignty. I've written about this elsewhere. But I think with John Calvin, it's all right to use the word free once it's rightly understood in terms of our choices. They're voluntary. We choose to do. Free markets depend on voluntary choices, and the Bible places a high value on people's voluntary choices. From the moment that God put Adam and Eve in the garden and said, of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for the day you eat of it you shall surely die, he gave them a freedom of choice. Or I put before you life and death, blessing and curse. Or choose you this day whom you will serve, Joshua 24. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Or in Revelation, the Spirit and the Bride say, come, and let him who hears say, come, and let him who comes drink the water of life without price. There is an emphasis from Genesis to Revelation on the value of willing, voluntary choices. And a free market system maximizes the opportunity to make those choices in an economic realm. By contrast, what's the opposite of freedom? It's slavery. The opposite of freedom is when government decides everything for you. It decides where you should work, what you can buy, what you can spend, how much money you get. That's a controlled economy. And that takes away the moral virtue of freedom of choice. That's number one, promotes freedom of choice from moral actions. Number two, moral benefit of a free market system. It promotes freedom to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits. That is, in a free market, the government doesn't assign you what career you're going to take up. You have freedom to choose that. Margaret and I have three sons. One of them decided to be an art major. We thought, oh, well. Not going to support himself, but, it's his choice. So he made that choice. Turns out he later taught himself programming. He's a web designer. He's making more on an annual salary than I've ever made. So the joke was on us. But it's so funny. People in a free market society can choose to pursue careers in music and become guitar players if they want, start a band. They can choose to pursue careers in theology or any other Christian ministry as a career or a part-time vocation, and they can choose to fund those things. No evangelical seminaries of any significance exist in government-controlled economies. Zero. I've been in a seminary in Beijing, their premier seminary. It's just pathetic. Pathetic is the only word I can think of for it. No significant publishing houses exist in government-controlled economies, evangelical publishing houses, or academic publications. When's the last time you read a significant exegetical article on a Bible verse from someone in a communist country? Probably never. Totalitarian countries generally do not produce people who have freedom to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits. Nor do they have any significant evangelism of other countries. They don't have choice. And those things are not valuable to the controlled economy. So that's number two, freedom to pursue abstract or spiritual pursuits. Number three, free markets best promote personal integrity and truth-telling. When future voluntary exchanges are expected, individuals are more willing to do the right thing today. I've kept on going to the same Firestone auto dealer, auto repair place, Firestone Tire, in my neighborhood for all 13 years we've lived in Arizona. Why? Because when a problem with my car that I can't figure out can be fixed for $5, they say this is only a $5 cost. They tell me honestly, and I've had examples again. But I had another example of a car repair dealer who lied to me about a repair, and I'll never go back. Voluntary exchanges, the expectation of future voluntary exchanges, promotes truth-telling. If the grocer says this is fresh bread, it was baked this morning, and you get home and it's stale, you just don't go back to that grocer, as long as you have freedom to choose another grocer. So freedom in personal choice in a market promotes personal integrity and truth-telling. We get a little example of that from the Index of Economic Freedom, where they have measures of freedom from corruption. You go down to the bottom of the list, the most unfree countries, they all have low scores on corruption. So Venezuela, Myanmar, 14 out of 100. You got 14% on your midterm exam, you're not doing too well. 14 out of 100 for Myanmar and freedom from corruption. That means people are regularly lying and demanding bribes in Myanmar. And Uzbekistan, 16. Venezuela, 20. Russia, 21. Zimbabwe, 24. Huge corruption, just endemic in these unfree societies. Where you get high scores on freedom from corruption? In free countries with free markets. Denmark, 93. New Zealand, 93. Singapore, 93. Canada, 89. Netherlands, 88. Those are among the highest ever. Not that there are no corrupt people in those societies, but the free market promotes choice, personal integrity, and promotes truth-telling. Number four, a free market promotes accountability. Earlier this month, Barry and I were traveling to Cedarville University in Ohio, and they were putting us up in a hotel in Springfield, which is not too far from Cedarville. As we were driving toward the hotel, Barry said something like, you think this will be an okay hotel to stay in? And I said, Barry, it's a Marriott. I've never stayed in a bad Marriott in my life. They have brand identity to protect, and every employee is rewarded for helping to protect that brand identity. And it was a great hotel. It was quiet. It was clean. Everything was neat. I mean, I love staying at Marriott's because they do hotels right. Okay? There's a system that promotes, and if they stop, I hope I'm not insulting anybody here, but I was in the Charlotte airport and I bought a Quiznos sandwich once that was horrible. And I just don't go back to Quiznos anymore. And they're having financial problems. Why? They didn't have the accountability means you do a bad job, you lose. So free markets promote accountability. Fifth, and I'm coming to an end here because I want to give Barry time now too. Promoting earned success. Recent research, especially by Arthur Brooks, now president of the American Enterprise Institute, says that extensive sociological study shows that the primary economic factor in making people happy is not money, but earned success. He said earned success means having responsibility and then doing well at it. And when I started talking about this with a student who was my teaching assistant at Phoenix Seminary once, he said, let me give you an example. I knew a little bit of his background. When he was in high school, he began dealing drugs, writing fraudulent checks, went to jail. In fact, I don't know if you know about Joe Arpaio's notorious tent city outside of Phoenix, but he was in Joe Arpaio's tent city. And after a while, he got out. Somehow, he got a job at Wendy's. And one day, his manager came by and said, you're doing a good job keeping the French fries hot. He said that was revolutionary. He realized that he had a job and he was responsible and he was doing well at it. And he thought, you know, if I keep keeping the French fries hot, I might get to be a shift manager. And maybe I could even manage a Wendy's myself someday. Turned out he became a believer. He finished high school. He went to Arizona State University, got straight A's all the way through, came to Phoenix Seminary, straight A's, was my teaching assistant. Now he's second year at Cornell University Law School. Earned success. Free markets best promote the opportunity to have earned success. In a controlled economy, you have so many regulations, you can't hire or fire people for their job performance, but only by political connections. A free market system allows everyone the possibility to try different ideas and occupations and end up with things they do well. Well, I'm just going to say, as far as greed is concerned, Barry and I say a free market system does not depend on greed. It depends on people exercising self-interest. And self-interest in Scripture is a morally good thing. It can be used to excess, and then it becomes greed. But I see Ann Bradley in the back nodding her head. self-interest is what you do when you try to eat right, when you exercise, when you read your Bible for spiritual nourishment. Self-interest is what you do when you look both ways before you cross the street. Self-interest is working so that you get reward for that work. There's nothing wrong with that. God has set up the system of the universe so it encourages accountability and responsibility in us to have earned success and to use self-interest for good. Now, a free market doesn't eliminate greed, but it does moderate greed, and so people whose primary purpose is to earn money, the best way to earn money is to make a product that other people like, and like an app that other people will buy. And so greed is channeled into productive purposes in many ways, but it depends on self-interest. And then I'm going to mention one more and I'll be done. Free markets number 10 encourage prioritizing the wants of others. The free market leads to competition, and oh, maybe you've grown up in an American educational system in which competition is a swear word and you're not supposed to say it or like it or anything. But you know what competition is? Competition is a good thing when it prompts a company to improve everything it can to satisfy a consumer. Free market competition is not about destroying a competitor, but about better satisfying consumers, and that's, you know, that begins to sound very much like loving your neighbor as yourself, doing good for others. I saw in the newspaper a few months ago, the annual airline performance scores came out. And it was Delta, it was American, it was United, it was Southwest. And Delta ranked worst on lost baggage. So the reporter, I think it was USA Today, phoned up a Delta spokesperson and said, what is your comment on this? And the Delta person said, we're going to send people to sabotage United, American, and Southwest baggage handling systems so that they have a lot of lost baggage too. No, that isn't what they said, right? No, they said, we've reevaluated our system and we're going to do much better next year. We're going to satisfy consumers' demand that their baggage get to the right place at the right time. See, it isn't about destroying a competitor. It's about striving to serve the customer better. And we all benefit from that. Free market promotes that in a healthy way. Well, there are a lot of other moral advantages of the free market system, but isn't it a good thing? I think there are a lot of moral qualities that are reinforced and strengthened by a free market system. That's why Barry and I like it.
Thanks, Wayne. Mm-hmm. It is so brazen just to come up and stand and say, poverty of nations. So, unbiased, are you ready for something unbiased? Maybe one of the greatest economic books ever written was The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith in 1776. That's when he wrote it. And that has carried the day for almost 250 years. In my heart of hearts, I think this book, The Poverty of Nations, is going to carry the day for 100 years. I believe that everything that Wayne said, you heard the first sentence, second sentence. Now add 2-3 paragraphs right under that, just to kind of solidify it, give more examples and punch it home. Then Wayne would say this, 2, 3, 4 sentences, but now add 2 or 3 more paragraphs. That's what you get in the book. That's where you get the book. It'll be one of your favorite books of all time. Okay, so that's brazen, that's brazen, that's brazen. Freedom is the mainspring of economic progress. Freedom is a virus for which there is no antidote. Freedom is a country's best investment. Free markets are a miraculous instrument of communication. The free market is a stupendous transmitter of ideas while determining value. The free market is like a galactic bathroom scale where millions and millions and billions of supply and demand determining price, supply and demand determine wages, supply and demand determine interest rates, supply and demand determining profits, supply and demand determine losses. Here's the thing, it's like a dynamic, billions and billions of people participating in this, and it all ends up in an equilibrium, bam, price, bam, and that price, that thing, that price has a million connotations. When you throw up a supply curve on the blackboard, a supply curve, behind that supply curve is all the technology, all the ingenuity, all the creativity, a little inch at a time, a mile at a time. And so it is unbelievable just to throw up that supply curve, much less than put in a demand curve and find the equilibrium point and find the point called equilibrium price. And that price is the signal. It's what Adam Smith called the invisible hand of the market. It's dynamic. It's complicated. It cannot be understood by the human mind. It is too complicated, way beyond any one human, because it's millions of humans making choices, millions of things going on. A freeze of the coffee price down in South America, and wham, 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 all these things are happening, because so every dimension comes in. So no one person, no one group could ever figure out here. So that's why this is so absolutely, absolutely beautiful. Now, here I am standing for you. What a privilege. What a privilege to get to stand before you. Now, would I like to grab some more of this economics and just pound it in. Yes, I would, but I'm not going to. You know why I'm not going to? Because I want to do something that I think in a spiritual sense is even more important than making little economists out of you. And I like to make that clarify too. I like to say microeconomists, because to say economists in a general term, this is the most confused group of folks in the world, macroeconomists. These macroeconomists that are running the Federal Reserve System, that are in the White House now, you couldn't find a bigger bunch of goofballs in the whole world. They're living in fantasy. It's a fantasy world that literally. They're going to try to tell you and me that income is a function of consumption, investment, and government, and that government is as important as investment consumption. They're going to try to tell you that the government multiplier is bigger than the consumption multiplier. The government multiplier is bigger than the investment multiplier. Translated, the more money that you can get to government so they can spend it has more impact on the economy. I would tell my dad that. Finance is a good part of my degrees. Kept saying, what is a Keynesian economics? Dad, tax the rich, give to the poor. Dad, let government spend it. Dad, government is benevolent. They know where it'll have more impact. The government multiplier is bigger. Finally, my dad just couldn't take it anymore. He said, Bob, out of here. And I kind of finished my breakfast, and I walked out. I walked to the kitchen door, and I said, I'll be seeing you, pal. Bam, and I slammed the door. 5 years out of my dad's life. What an idiot. My dad, with no education, understands that the government multiplier is not bigger than the consumption. My dad, without any education, knows that before government can do anything, it first must tax. Before government can do anything, it's got to take your money first. What in heaven's name are we thinking? The government with more of a multiplier than the consumption multiplier. But that's how Obama learned it at Harvard. That's the way it's taught in most secular economics departments. C plus I plus G equals income. And it's the government is the main pendulum. The government is the mix that makes us the stew. Nothing could be more confused. Nothing could be more wrong. Our founding fathers gave their lives to figure out how you can limit government. Gave their lives to say, okay, let's start here. A constitution that has some delegations and enumerations. Government, these are your delegated powers, but no more. Government, these are your enumerated powers, but no more. How about three branches of government? A legislative, an executive, a judicial. Why all of that? To limit government. To have state versus federal, somehow counteracting, somehow try, what? To limit government. The founding fathers knew that. A bigger government means a smaller citizen, period. A bigger government means a smaller individual, period. They knew that. They didn't want a smaller individual. They did not want a smaller citizen. They did not want government. So when Thomas Jefferson comes up with this idea of endowed by our Creator with certain innumerable rights. Oh, really? Not endowed by government, not endowed by politics, not endowed by wealth, not endowed by education. No. Endowed by our Creator. Oh, this whole new government is going to take a whole new centerpiece here. It's not going to be government. It's not going to be politics. So that's just the beginning. That's 1776, the Declaration of Independence. Then a few years later, this government, this country, is going to be a country. You know, is there water up here? Yeah, I need it already. I didn't think I'd get this wound up quite this quick. If you tone yourself down, it doesn't happen.
Go for it, Mary.
Constitutional law, delegation, enumerated powers, three houses, blah, 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 blah. Then government says, look at the founding fathers, a government big enough to give you anything you want is big enough to take everything that you have. So the founding fathers, again, to limit government. So they said by and large that democracy is fundamentally unstable. Unstable in this sense. 51% of us can outvote 49%. We, maybe the takers mainly, can take everything that the makers have made. So it's unstable. I mean, in the name of democracy, we're going to raise taxes to 39%. In the name of democracy, we're now going to make it 44%. In the name of democracy, see, you can take everything. So the founding fathers recognized that a democracy is fundamentally unstable. It's like having two wolves and one sheep deciding what we're going to have for dinner. And so it's not. And so it was very clear in the founding father's mind the definition of politics. Poly means many, ticks, a blood-sucking insect. So they had it. They had it right. Okay, so now we're going to limit government? No. So now back to Jefferson, 1787. We're going to be a country of property owners. And why is this so clear? Now, of course, Jefferson gets the idea from John Locke. It was John Locke who said in about 1670, 1680, John Locke said that private property is the bulwark of freedom. I started out here. Freedom is the mainspring. Freedom is a virus. Freedom is a country's best investment. You heard me. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The free market is miraculous. The free market is stupendous. Okay. But now we're getting down to the nubs. Private property is the bulwark, John Locke said, of freedom. Private property. Now, why would that be cool? That would be the case because the minute you have a private property side, you diffuse economic power. Otherwise, it's all going to end up with government. Government will have all of it. But when we have private property, you have a home and a title to the home. You have a little business and a deed to that business. You own a car and you have a license and a title to it. Aha! It's yours, man. It's yours. And so the more you can diffuse economic power, the more you can limit government. So getting verifiable addresses, which we talked about last night, verifiable addresses, and then titles and deeds and property documents, the whole idea of that is not that it works smoothly. It does work. Wayne explained how smooth it works. Look at North Korea, South Korea. But the main idea, limit government. Private property is the bulwark of freedom. It limits government. Individual freedom, personal freedom, that's what you need, private property. So, that's it. Okay, would I now like to take those points and keep pounding them away? No, read the book. Read the book. It'll be one of the best books you ever read, and it'll be in your library from now to the end of time. And just as a little hint, get Wayne's signature on that darn book before he leaves. He's also getting near 70 years old. This man's only got a few years left, and we're both going to be in nursing homes. And you're going to visit. I'm older than Wayne, so Wayne, I hate to do that to you. But don't pass up. Wayne will hate me when I say this, but we have genius in our midst. You know how fortunate I am to be a co-author of this? Are you kidding me? A country boy from eastern Colorado who doesn't know up from down half the time? Oh, yes, I cried my eyes out when I got my first B, too. But it's because the first B I ever got. You cry your eyes out when you get a B. Oh, no, because it's the first B, you get all A's. And so a little bit different. Okay, now, Barry, let's move. Okay, so where do I want to take this on? Don't tell me I'm half done already. Here's where I want to take this. Listen. For you all, there is nothing that I want more for you all. To become a little economist, no. To understand the economy better, no. The things that are to love America the way Dinesh D'Souza loves America. Of course, I want you to love America. It's a great place. Blah blah. But is that going to be my desire this morning? That you come out with a love affair of America? No. A love affair with Jesus. Now here's the tricky thing though. When you're in a seminary and in around it, and it's all of what it is consuming, it can be so easy to substitute things for the love of Jesus. To substitute, I'm going to memorize Psalm 1, I'm going to memorize Psalm 9, I'm going to memorize Psalm 51, I'm going to memorize Psalm 139. I've done that. And it's not unimportant. Don't get me wrong. It's not unimportant. 1 Corinthians 13. I did the chapel service for Arizona Christian University a couple weeks. And I started out and I did the first 13 verses as meaningful as I could with 1 Corinthians 13. Okay. So look at that dude. He's got a tie on. He's got a suit on and he knows 1 Corinthians 13. Good for him. And there's nothing wrong with that. Please understand there's nothing. But you can get caught in the academics, you can get caught in the books, you can get caught in the memorization, you can get caught, and it's like a vice. It'll start gripping you down, and all of a sudden, it takes the very joy of your Christian life out. It's our love for Jesus. It's understanding that in God's kingdom, the way up is down. This is so opposite everything I teach in economics. Early bird gets the worm. Be proactive. Not to decide is to decide. Not to do it is to do blah, 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 blah. All those things. Beans. In God's kingdom, the way up is down. Now, here's the first true truth that's come in my talk so far. This is absolute true truth. On your way up the ladder, whatever that would be, I guarantee you, you will be passing Jesus on the way down. The first shall be last. There's victory in defeat. The Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful. Humble. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in everything with humility, consider others more important than yourself. Love, patience, kindness, humility, love. Have the same attitude that it was Christ Jesus, in that though he was God, did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but he was willing to become nothing. He becomes a man. He walks among us. He becomes obedient to death, even death on a cross. Humble. Jesus, the prodigal son, teaches. Why does he give us that parable? That prodigal son deserved to get his butt kicked over the moon. He takes one third of the family wealth and poops it away. Comes home. His dad meets him with a ring, a robe, and a feast. Grace. Grace. Undeserved? Unmerited? Got it. Got it. You bet. Undeserved, unmerited, unearned. Grace. Jesus giving the parable of the landowner, a denarius, to the guy that comes to work in the morning, and after they've all worked different times, including a guy that comes on right before quitting time. Now he pays them all, and he gives this guy, right before quitting time, the same amount of money as he gave the guy that was there at 8 o'clock in the morning and worked all day long. And the guy that says, hey, what is this? I've worked all day. Hey, but you agreed for a denarius. Jesus is not trying to give us some management seminar here. He's trying to show us what grace is about. Grace is even the guy that comes on. Grace is that thief hanging on the cross. The one thief says, if you're the Son of God, get us down from here. The other thief says, this is a good man. This is a good man. He's done nothing wrong. Will you remember me when you come into your kingdom? He says to Jesus. And what does Jesus say to him? Today, today, thou shalt be with me in paradise. Get it? Do you get it? Do you see the grace? So, you, as you're moving through seminar, how easy it is to get caught up in some other things and miss the main idea here. The main idea is our need for Jesus. The main idea is to be able to see our own sinfulness. The main idea here is that the Apostle Paul, at the end of his ministry, says, I'm the greatest of sinners. To see that we don't stand in some kind of a righteous position, but we too are at the foot of the cross, pleading for God's mercy, and so thankful for his mercy, and so thankful for his grace. So we're always growing in Jesus, growing in him, growing in love. Oh, yeah, I know, Wayne. So that's my little opening. I get three more times today. This is just one. But I said, I just got up this morning and said, I just don't want this one to slip away. And the day is over. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I miss telling you, my heart, that the way up in God's kingdom is down. Down to the feet of Jesus. Are you constantly in that mode? But God demonstrated his love for us, and that while we were yet sinners, he died for us. So we take on his righteousness, not our own, but his. And so I'll just end this by saying, I know you know Ephesians 2:8-9, for by grace are you saved through faith, not of works, I know, but make sure you read the 4 or 5 verses prior to Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. In other words, start on Ephesians 2, start with verse 5, and check out those 5 verses, and then hook on, for by grace are ye saved through faith. His mercy, his love, his grace. That's my heart for you, that you don't miss it. Okay.
Thank you, Barry.
Okay.
Ken said we can go till 10 after. So we have some interaction on the question of free market. How does it work and the moral value of the free market? Matt again.
Yeah. If there is no such thing as a free market, then why use the term? Why not find a better term that merges both government control and free market? And my second question is, how in this country, which largely seems to be a corporatocracy, are growing more and more towards favoring corporations and their vote as both individuals and favoritism. How do you kind of align that or critique that?
I didn't mean to say at the beginning there's no such thing as a free market. At least the top 20 or so countries have something that's worthy of being called a free market. Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, Switzerland, New Zealand, Canada, Chile, Ireland, Denmark, Estonia, the United States. We're right with the United Kingdom now, 12 and 14. Yeah, and Taiwan, Germany. Germany's down to 18. Sure, those have free... It's, see, what I don't want is to say, is to make everything blurry.
But they're a balance, though. I mean, it's not just a free market.
No, but the more free they are, the more prosperous they become, and the more moral value there is to the way the economy functions. So it's very worth talking about. It's like someone saying, see, I live in Phoenix, where we get almost no rain, and my son for a while lived in Seattle, where it's raining all the time. It's like someone saying, well, you know, every city has rain, so why are you talking about dry cities and wet cities? Well, there is a difference, even though it's a quantitative difference. There is a difference between Singapore and North Korea, Australia and North Korea, and Cuba. And sure, you know, there are free markets in the world that function quite well. They could always do better, but we're not going to get perfection in this age. So,
and corporatocracy, do you think that's a concern in this country, considering the way the influence it has on government as well?
Well, you know, I spent some time recently with Ron Sider's book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. And the major message you get from his book is corporations are evil. That's what you get from the media today as well. And you can just focus. It'd be like a replay reel of all the mistakes, all the times that Derek Jeter struck out or bobbled the ball in the infield, and then you play 15 or 20 of those over his career and say what a horrible player he is. Yeah, you could focus on the negatives forever.
Corporatocracy is just a big word. Look it. If there was really corporatocracy, tell me why that the corporate tax rate is the highest in the world. The 35% corporate tax rate in America is the highest in the world. So if there was really corporatocracy, you don't think they would have the power using the political process? No, 30, 25, 20, 15. See, corporate tax rates throughout the world now are all going down, and they're kind of landing at about 15 to 20%. I just came from Calgary, Canada, and we were visiting about the province of Alberta, where Calgary is the biggest city, and they've got the corporate tax down to 15% in Alberta, 15%. And I tell you, boy, is there excitement and all the rest as far as economics. So if there's really a corporatocracy, explain why then we're taxing these people out of our minds. Yeah. So it's just a cute word that
and the
people
government,
are using.
Government regulation of corporations is greater than it's ever been in the United States.
Oh my gosh, they've
so
got,
we've got
it's no fun running a corporate anymore. You've got to fill in. I was with Ernst & Young this week in Phoenix, where they're going through the Obamacare and what they're going to require of people in Obamacare. And all the 1,000 people in the audience want to do is just give us a knife and some razor blades now. We're going to go ahead and slit our wrists and slit our throat. Are you kidding me? You're going to bring all this firepower, and now the speaker said, and if any of you think you're going to get away from us, the IRS is going to be increased by 16,000. 16,000 new IRS agents to monitor you even closer. And the corporate people just want to vomit right there on their spots. I mean, corporatocracy?
Okay.
And yes. Okay, next question. Next thing.
You persuaded me.
I hear it all the time. And that it were true.
Yes.
And you have hinted that probably Christian worldview is most conducive for this.
Yes.
And even if you look at the map, you can see that most of the prosperous countries have some influence of Christianity.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what is the case of Japan? What makes it so prosperous?
Japan has a form of Buddhism that makes work into a religion, and that will make you prosperous. But they've lost the Christian ideal of rest and leisure and enjoyment. So they have high degree of suicide, high degree of family breakdown. But you don't have to be explicitly Christian to have values that promote prosperity, and Japan has that.
Yep. Values.
Yep.
So, and one of the things that you have stressed is the importance of having a title.
Yeah.
Title. Like my context, I belong to a tribe, and I'm from India.
Oh.
We don't have value for our land.
Right.
Which is our main resource.
Yep.
So if we go to a bank to borrow, they don't recognize our land.
Right. You don't have documented property rights.
Right. So in this kind of situation, as Christians, should we not help them?
Yes.
While they're in the process of growth.
Yes.
Instead of saying, you know, like helping them doesn't.
Yes.
Really.
Yes, I agree. Okay.
Yeah. Since you, India, did you say? I had the chance to listen in person to Prime Minister Singh a number of years ago, and here was his speech. He's talking to really 1.3 billion people, not in this speech, maybe only a couple thousand, but a billion heard this speech. He said this, why is it that Indians from India are the richest demographic group in the Silicon Valley, California? Why is it that Indians from India are the richest demographic group from Cape Town, South Africa? Why is it Indians from India create most of the wealth in Kenya, 70% of the wealth in this African country called Kenya? So that wherever we go, Indians for India do very, very well, except in India. And he said, listen, I was born a Hindu, I'll die a Hindu, I believe in Hinduism, but that doesn't mean that Hinduism is correct on every single point. And to put entrepreneurs and business people only one step above the untouchables in the caste system is ridiculous. And he says to, do you know what they do in America? They celebrate entrepreneurs. They celebrate entrepreneurs. So not only think they're untouchable, that they sell. So his point to his country is, we better be rethinking this. Well, let me tell you, when the prime minister of a country is talking, it's one thing to Barry and Wayne to go in and talk to some leaders. But so. They've got to hear it, they've got to understand it, and pretty soon even the prime minister of Albania came to understand he hadn't heard about doing 20 and 30 year leases on that beach land. He's now heard it. They're doing it, etc. So that's exciting. That's exciting. So like culture is the hardest, we say that, chapter 9, it's the last chapter in our book on values. It's the hardest thing to change, no doubt about it. But interestingly, it can be done. Japan, agricultural nation, and yet Japan changes its culture. South Korea, same thing. So country after country after country. They can do it, they will do it, but it really does have to come from kind of high up, although it doesn't hurt to always be reinforced by the church and people down here either.
And let me add, as a theology professor, that part of my conviction that what we're saying in this book has a hope of being persuasive is that throughout the last 2,000 years, the gospel has come to various cultures and various societies in the world, and it has changed them. So first people become born-again believers by having faith in Christ, but then the teachings of Scripture change people's hearts. And barbarians and Germanic hordes and Viking raiders, etc., become transformed by the gospel, and eventually the educational system is transformed, the value system is transformed, the culture is transformed, and we're just hoping that continues as the Word of God has power to transform all of life. That's one thing I want to say. And before we just, I've got time for probably two more questions, but we've been talking about free market. We list six components necessary for a free market: private property, documented ownership of private property, rule of law, so that free market doesn't mean the Wild West and anarchy. Free market means criminals are punished, okay? And if you break a contract, you pay a fine, etc. So rule of law, fair court system, so that you can't bribe the judge, so that contracts can be enforced. So what do we have? A stable currency.
Low tax rates.
Low tax rates. So we've got six things. Property, documents of property, low tax rates, stable currency, rule of law, and fair courts. So those six things, and then you've got a functioning free market. And that's what we mean. Okay?
My fault. We went over time. We got some great session. I can hardly wait for the 10:30 session to begin. It's going to be terrific.
We've got 5 minutes left.
Oh, we do?
Mm-hmm. Ken said 10 after.
If Ken said it, that's law.
I don't know the answer to that question. Ken?
Sorry, I was reading something.
Ann? I'm kind of calling out this. What's the connection between free markets and families?
I think that the family is the core unit of society. I mean, the individual is the core unit of choice. So individuals make choices, but we do that within the context of the family. And so I think the opportunities for the family to thrive taking dominion is in a prosperous society. So if you think about family life in the Soviet Union under communism and the family life in America, sure, there's more vices. But there were vices then in communism. They just appear differently. They manifest differently. So I still think what you're saying is right, is that the heart has to be transformed first, whether you have prosperity or not. But if you do have prosperity, you're more likely to have heart transformation. These biblical principles are at the core of what they're talking about.
Okay. And Jeff, are you running? Who's running the slides here? Somebody back. What's your name?
Drew.
Yeah, I can't get this to turn that off.
Okay. You want it completely off?
Hit the letter B. Usually B on PowerPoint blanks the screen. Turns it to a black screen. That's what I wanted. Thank you, B. All right. I can't get this to work. All right, name?
It's Richard.
Richard?
I wanted to ask how you kind of hinted at this already, but I was curious about, but how a free market system, like, does it, and if it does, how does it curb industries that we would say are evil, and yet people have, like, there's a demand for...
Okay, how does a free market curb industries that are evil? If you have rule of law, you punish breaking contracts. You hold people accountable for making ladders that break so people hurt themselves. So there's accountability, there's product liability responsibilities in a free market. And that's rule of law. But how does it curb, what did you say?
Like industries that we would say are evil in themselves and yet seem to have a high demand.
Well, pornography or drugs. Okay, some things you outlaw, some things you say we're going to put restrictions on. But if you have a rule of law, the society, it's a political decision to regulate that. But there's something else, and that is, and Margaret and I tried to watch a movie the other night, and we thought it got good reviews, and it just felt morally awful. It was PG-13. It wasn't R-rated or anything. And we're just saying, the movies are just awful these days. What's happened is you've got a society that has people's hearts that have turned away from God, and they're demanding in a free market society what they want, and what they get is what they demand. So there's a sense in which there's an interplay in a free market. A free market allows freedom for societies to make wrong choices. I understand that. So, but is a government-controlled economy better? It takes away the freedom. So, all right. And we have freedom to make good choices.